Thank you very much, Chairman. And it's interesting to see we're all in airline-style seating tonight. Hopefully there isn't any overbooking, and I'm sure if so, Dougal will have some henchmen to randomly drag people out. It was fascinating to see Dayman's target of R&D as a percentage of GDP being put up there. The first time I was lucky enough to be invited to speak to this audience was exactly 13 years ago on the occasion of a previous government's launch of a GDP target. I was then tasked with the speech title, How Does the City Value R&D? I'm not sure I successfully answered that question, but I then went into industry and potentially have some more answers. I'm responsible now for trying to get people to invest in IEG, and I'll introduce you to that in a minute. But I do think the final point I'm going to make is about patient capital and the need for that in the UK really to be an underpinning of any industrial strategy. And it was raised, in fact, in the letter from the House of Lords Select Committee. But just quickly to introduce IEG to you, for those of you that don't know, it stands for International Airline Group. And we're the fifth largest airline group in the world on whatever metric you choose to use, be it number of planes or passengers. We carried 100 million passengers last year to 268 destinations. A lot of planes. We spend £2.5 billion a year in gross investment in in aeronautical engineering. And we have 65,000 employees, most of whom are skilled in some way or another, and the biggest core group of skills is in aeronautical engineering. So we're worth about £13 billion now in the market. We're number 38 in the FTSE 100, in spite of all the many things that have been going on in the last 12 months to hit our UK business. And in the UK, we own British Airways and Avios, with bases where you know them to be. 44 million passengers last year in and out of the UK, which makes us the connector, effectively, between UK and the rest of the world. We have 40,000 employees directly working for us in the UK, many tens of thousands of more, perhaps a multiple of that, working for us indirectly in the supply chain. So I just wanted to run through a few practical reading the green paper, a few practical things where we as a big business think we could interface with the industrial strategy, make use of the industrial strategy to grow our business, grow employment in the UK, and connect the UK better to the rest of the world. So dividing it into the pillars of the strategy, first of all, developing skills, pillar two. I mentioned that a lot of our workforce, here you see 8,000 people are directly labeled as engineers, working on our aircraft, maintaining our aircraft, but also working with the manufacturers of engines and airframes to develop the aircraft of the future as one of the main potential buyers of those planes in the future. Now we have, as you can see in the UK, two major bases in Heathrow and Gatwick. Those are our legacy spots. But over the last 20 years, we've also invested in greenfield sites for engineering in Glasgow, and in South Wales, both for airspace engineering, airframe engineering, and also for avionics and parts engineering. Now, we're at the moment completely reshaping how we do this across Europe. We're inheriting a lot of legacy positions from our different operating companies that we've acquired over the last 5 years. And in the next 3 years, we have to decide as a business, do we centralize certain functions in certain countries that will then specialize in those functions for the future and support our growth as a business. So having a core skills base in this aeronautical engineering long-term leading position that the UK has in the world is a big facilitator for our business in the future, and any support we can have through an industrial strategy will be very welcome and influence the decisions at board level when they get taken over the next 3 years. Pillar two, again, developing skills. It's not just hardware engineers, it's software engineers that are key to our industry. I picked Avios. It's a pure digital business. There are no assets other than its algorithms and its people. Hopefully many of you collect Avios in the room. And here we're investing a huge amount in data analytics, artificial intelligence, ultimately to help you collect more, and what's probably more important to you, be able to book more seats when you actually have the points. That is something we're investing in the UK. It's based exclusively in the UK, currently in Crawley, but thinking of relocating to central London. And we really feel the UK, in terms of its tech prowess within Europe, is the best place to base this business, which we hope in the future will be a global leader, not just a European leader as it is now. Developing skills again in the tech area, I'm not allowed to tell you how much. We're investing in a multi-million pound fund to invest in startups. But this could be, for example, to invest in, as Daiman, you referred to, automated guided vehicles. So for example, in the airport of the future, and I'll come onto that in a slide's time, perhaps you might drive yourself still to the airport, but you get met by an automated guided vehicle somewhere on the perimeter road that welcomes you, knows who you are, takes you direct to your aircraft without having to go through the duty-free shops, although you can choose to go if you want. And most importantly, checks you and your luggage while you're in the vehicle so that it's much more secure. If you're deemed to be not secure, you're taken to a different place rather than the aircraft. But it's fantastic for customers, much safer, and will speed you on your journey. So this is the kind of thing we want to invest in. And again, having this as a key pillar in the industrial strategy will be very helpful. So that next slide, the airport of the future. This is a map of potentially how Heathrow will be developed, with a runway 3 in the northwest there, crossing the M25. We're putting a huge amount of effort, and it's myself and Tim Cross, who's in the room, by the way, a Cambridge aeronautical engineer graduate, who are leading IG's participation in this very exciting, but at the moment very expensive project. And we're at the moment trying to reduce the cost, make it much more affordable for the UK and for customers and for airlines based here, but introduce lots of exciting new innovation along the lines of what I've just mentioned. And we're facing a lot of roadblocks in this, not least from the DfT and its lack of engagement with us and our competitors in this area. And I'll touch on that in a few slides' time. Pillar 6, encouraging trade and inward investment. It's a bit of an obvious point, I suppose. We do connect the UK to the rest of the world, but this is a subsection, you can see in the pie chart on the right, of the industries, the business we actually carry around the world every year, in and out of the UK. And you can see it's very diverse. It's not just financials, which is the key biggest sector, but really every sector that the UK leads in. We underpin that in allowing people to export their services and bringing other people into the UK. In fact, sadly, the financial sector is spending less with us. Travel policies at people like Barclays have been halved over the last 3 years. And our biggest sector now, collectively, is government. So thank you for your business. And we hope to enjoy more of that as the Brexit negotiations kick off. It's not actually the most profitable. We don't make a huge amount of money out of carrying civil servants. The most profitable sector actually is people who sit in our premium cabins and are visiting friends and relatives. And I'll come onto that in this next slide. So London, and here, cultivating world-leading sectors, aviation, both the engineering of it and the delivery of it, is really a UK, unquestionably a UK world-leading sector already. So what I've put here on the graph is just adding up all of the airports in each big city around the world, how many people went in and out of those airports in 2015. So you can see London, and that's Heathrow, Gatwick, Stansted, Luton, London City, and I think I may have included Southend there. 147 million people went in and out of London that year. The next biggest, New York, then Tokyo, then Hong Kong, Shenzhen, Beijing, Atlanta, Paris, you can see the next biggest city in Europe, is completely overshadowed by London. Then Chicago, Shanghai, LA. So you have quite a few domestic cities there. But in terms of international, really it's London, New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, Shenzhen, which are the world leaders. And even with a relatively low rate of growth in the future, we'd like the growth to be much higher if the industrial strategy really works. Even with a low rate of growth, London will still be, in 30 years' time, still up there in the top three. But the quote I put in there on the left-hand side, some special pleading, the airline industry has always been incredibly fragile. So this is Warren Buffett's most famous quote. He has many quotes about airlines. Think airlines, here a durable competitive advantage has proven elusive ever since the days of the Wright brothers. If a far-sighted capitalist had been present at Kitty Hawk, he would have done his huge successors, his successors a huge favor by shooting Orville down. And our investors remind us of that quote every day in challenging us to perform well. Warren Buffett has just completely ignored his own quote in 2007 and invested a huge amount of his money in US airlines. But the fact is, British Airways, and I'll come on to talk about this at the end, in the last 15 years has only paid a dividend three times. It's had a huge loss decade. Any kind of strategy is a help for us. But the starting point we have in dealing with government and dealing with officials is one almost of antagonism, if not hostility. The idea that we make a lot of money so we don't need any help is perhaps a starting point for many people we see in government. And we think we can hopefully transform that if the strategy really takes root in this part of the world. So we think there are going to be need to be foundations under these pillars to help us really make use of the strategy. And really, I suppose these are like the gaps in Graham's talk. So foundation one, quality engagement. In this Runway 3 debate, and you may be completely surprised to hear me say this, we had no engagement with the government at all, in spite of the fact that we base £10 billion worth of assets at this airport. We have to make money off that. And over the next 25 years, in replacement cost terms, we and other airlines at this airport will have to spend £40 billion to stay in business here in aircraft equivalents. Just as an example of how little debate there's been, I've circled that runway 3 crossing the M25 is going to have to cross a 16-lane motorway, the busiest motorway in Europe, at its busiest point, next to the busiest motorway junction in Europe with the M4. The civil engineering of that still hasn't been bottomed out, let's say, how you actually cross the runway, let alone what about the disruption, the emissions, in terms of all that engineering and air quality reduction while that's going on. And the cost of it, because the engineering solution hasn't been designed yet, is not known, but probably in excess of £3 billion just to do that bridge. Now, if we'd been asked, we'd have said we don't need a runway that long. It doesn't need to be 3,500 meters, it could be 2,800 meters. And only 5% of the aircraft on the hottest day of the year flying to the furthest destinations in the world would have to use one of the other two runways. That could save potentially £3 billion. You could shift the runway slightly to the east, and a lot of disruption would be saved as well. But currently in our engagement, we're being told that wouldn't be then a northwest runway scheme, and the draft national policy statement states that the runway has to be a northwest runway. Who actually made that decision to put the runway there? We still don't know. Nobody's putting their hands up on that one. But that's just a concrete example of how the engagement in some of these key areas really has been lacking. And I think if the industrial strategy just allows officials to engage with us in a more constructive way, that would be an enormous advance. Foundation to fiscal policy. Graham mentioned tax. And here's some special pleading. I'm not sure I'm going to persuade you that this tax on us should be abolished. But the fact is, in air passenger duty, which is a business tax, every airline in the UK transporting passengers in and out of the UK has to pay the Treasury, and it collects in excess of £3 billion from us a year. So that huge infrastructure project at Heathrow is going to be entirely funded by the private sector, if it's affordable. And on top of that, then we contribute an extra toll to the UK government for general expenditure. But the graph here shows what happens, really. So these are Japanese tourist arrivals from 2000 to 2015, comparing Japanese tourists going to the UK and Japanese tourists going to Spain. Now, more Japanese tourists seem to want to go to Spain anyway, in the starting point there. But it's only down 13% in those 15 years. There's no tax on passengers from the Spanish government coming in and out of Spain. And the reason it's down is simply because there are no direct services between Japan and Spain. There are three flights a day between Japan and the UK, and yet the tax that has gone up hugely, a family of four has to pay £300 for the privilege of coming here. That is down 60% in the last 15 years. It's not because the UK has gone out of fashion in Japan. We could pick any number of other European countries that haven't gone down. The UK stands out as being something that has significantly lost out. And the irony is that the VAT receipts, an average tourist spends £1,200 while they're here. Think of the VAT receipts on that compared to, it would be a multiple of the APD, the air passenger duty that the Treasury collects. But if we go in, we haven't even been able to go in once to the Treasury in the last 15 years to make this argument. And we'd like to have a more intelligent debate about fiscal policy, with special pleading obviously on our part, but at least an open mind from the Treasury rather than just a closed door. And finally, patient capital. I picked the quote from the House of Lords letter, which was from Neil Woodford, who's I think probably the best fund manager in the UK. I would say that because he's one of our major shareholders as well. But international long-term patient capital providers such as sovereign wealth funds, the super funds in Australia, Asian sovereign wealth, Middle Eastern sovereign wealth, and indeed the US VC money are now recognizing this gap. The gap being there is great science here, but no scale-up capital. They're stepping into that gap. So where is the UK sovereign wealth fund? Well, we kind of have a huge fund, but it's not sovereign. So jumping to the bottom there, the total assets in UK defined benefit pension schemes, according to the Purple Book, which is the annual digest of these schemes, £1.34 trillion in those schemes. Now, because the interest rate environment has collapsed, and in no short measure because of quantitative easing, which has contributed a cumulative $435 billion to the UK economy, these schemes are now have had a ballooning of their liabilities since 2006 of £1 trillion. Now, I'm slightly cheating here. It's obviously not entirely linked to the interest rate decline, but it's almost entirely linked to that decline. And much of that is due to the policy of quantitative easing. So quantitative easing has pumped money into the economy and created this enormous black hole which companies have to fill. So this in the middle is how it's been filled. £136 billion has been raised over that time by selling UK equities. Now, that probably is actually companies like ourselves who have a big pension deficit. So maybe it's rational to sell us because of this deficit. But £75 billion of that has gone into buying more foreign equities. So the companies who've contributed, we ourselves have contributed more than £5 billion in that time to our pension fund, which is 10 times the dividend we've been able to pay, and equivalent to half our asset base. Companies in general have contributed £120 billion to fund the gap. So a significant amount of that money has actually gone straight out into the wider world to fund other equities in other parts of the world. UK allocation of equities in these funds has gone from 29% in 2006 to just 6.7% now. So this very fragmented 5,700 fund, doctrinaire pension fund industry, diversifying its portfolios according to good portfolio theory, means that there's been a huge drain of corporate capital from the UK out to other parts of the world. And that impacts, you know, the people in these schemes. 10.9 million people are in one of these schemes. And actually, 60% of those are in companies with more than 10,000 people. So these schemes are largely driven by former state-owned companies that were privatized. This is a government responsibility, effectively, which was privatized in the 80s and 90s in the UK and not in other parts of the world. And 4.1 million people are in schemes which in the top, are actively employed still in schemes that are in the top 208 sponsored schemes. So there's a big impact. If this were to be made sovereign, let's say if the government, let's not use the words bailout, but if the government were to somehow underwrite the liability and the future liability, which could be as much as $450 billion more contribution that companies have to make, if as a result of that underwriting, pension trustees were to, let's say, pool their funds in a wider fund, an independent fund, let's say along the lines of the Bank of England, but as a fund manager, this would unquestionably be one of the largest sovereign wealth funds in the world. And then just as with the Bank of England, perhaps a government underpinning an industrial strategy could give an investment strategy to this fund. The gap on science, you know, just the amount of money that's been increased from 2006 to 2016 into hedge funds was £120 billion. If a fraction of that were to have gone into patient capital, funding science research in the UK and innovation and translating that into something that's commercial, this could be a hugely powerful entity. So this may be total pie in the sky, but I thought I might set a few hairs running for the panel discussion. That's where I'd like to stop. Thank you.